Hey, welcome to the Conventional Sniper Podcast. I'm your spotter, Justin Colletti. Just to kick it off tonight, this is going to be episode 5, and we're going to have a special guest on here. It's going to be former Lieutenant Commander Jack McGee. Jack and I have been friends for a hot minute now, about a year or so. Yeah, so we've been friends for about a year, but before we get into that, let's go over the intel brief. We'll get some S2 into it. So, obviously, we've discussed before, but if you're new to the podcast, you could go ahead and head over to osokapparel.com, osok-apparel.com, and if you use the discount code SNIPERPODCAST, one word, all lowercase, get yourself 10% off. And like I've mentioned in all podcasts, in transparency, I reach out to them first and ask them if we could get some help on the podcast. I got some of their shirts and hats, and I kind of love having their baseball shirts on. It's like a, I guess I want to say like a capri shirt where it goes like halfway down your leg or down your arm, excuse me. I don't like some of their short sleeve stuff, even though I have one on right now, but I like their longer sleeve stuff. It's good for the range too, because I don't get eaten by bugs, or it's really nice and thin so I don't overheat too much. But anyway, if you go on their website, you can get some percentage off, 10% off. So anyway, Jack, hey, welcome to the podcast, man.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. So if you could just go into... for everyone, what you did. You're in the Navy, correct?
That's correct.
If you could just go into what you did in the Navy and what you do now.
I was an F-18 pilot in the Navy out of Cecil Field in Jacksonville, Florida. Made a couple of cruises to the Mediterranean. Got out after my first hitch after being extended a little bit. And then I went to a reserve unit in New Orleans, and I fly for Southwest Airlines now.
And how long have you been flying for Southwest?
I'm starting my 25th year, so...
Oh, man, close to early retirement, huh?
Yeah, pretty much.
How long were you in the Navy for?
10 years total, 8.5 active, basically.
Gotcha. And as an F-18 pilot, did you fly attack, or did you fly... Attack meaning to the ground. You engage targets on the ground, or are you primarily a fighter guy?
We did both missions, but I gravitated towards ground attack.
And why is that?
I like to blow things up.
says every grunt, right? All right. So, as I know it now, you have two sons.
That's correct.
Names?
Connor and Ian.
How old are they?
26 and 24.
Oh, man, ripe old ages, right? Yeah, both Marines. All right. Yeah. So, explain what they do.
The older brother, Connor, is a scout sniper in the Marine Corps, and the younger brother, Ian, is a ground intelligence officer who has also been to the officer's portion of the sniper school in Quantico, and he's commander of a sniper platoon.
Okay, we're going to have him on to discuss that from the Marine Corps side. We've got an Army officer lined up to come on, but in the Army you don't have officers that are integrated into the sniper sections. Sniper sections are primarily enlisted billets. So you'll have the scout platoon, which will have an officer, but the sniper section will have no officers in it, which is good and bad.
Basically similar. He would be, you know, an scout platoon type person, not necessarily pushing out into the field like his older brother.
Gotcha. All right. So being a Navy guy, how'd you feel about your sons joining the Marine Corps?
Well, you know, my old man was in the Air Force, and when I joined the Navy, he was like, ah, you idiot. And, you know, when my sons told me they were joining the Marines, I was like, oh, my God, you idiots. But I'm just, you know, I'm really glad for them. My expectation and hope for them was that they would do something exceptional in their lives, and I think their career paths are. You know, as many career paths in the military, it's different and a lot more responsibility a lot sooner in your life, and they're working for the good guys, so I'm proud of them for that.
Fair enough. Yeah. I guess that's all you can really expect, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, getting on to Connor's, I guess, direction in life. He's a scout sniper.
That's correct.
I've known and I've talked to him, you know, quite a bit. We've hung out and shared some beers and some stories. But I guess the bigger question, and one that's not answered so often, is how do you feel being a dad? Your Navy service aside, how do you feel being a dad that your son is a sniper?
I'm proud of him. I think it's a really special thing to do. You know, it's very uncommon, and I'm proud that he made it through the, you know, stringent requirements of the Marine Corps to be able to wear a hog's tooth. So, you know, I pretty much brag about both of my sons all the time as a result of their service. So I'm good with it. Their mother's a little bit nervous, but when she gets upset, I just tell them the bad guys should be afraid, not her. So
Fair enough. I would agree, definitely. What's the biggest thing you hear from him all the time as to why he's a sniper?
You mean when if people ask me what's he doing and
like what does he tell you is the main reason why he wanted to become a sniper?
Well,
I should have clarified that in that question. I was kind of searching for it in my head, but
well, going back to my chagrin with them both joining the Marine Corps and Connor, of course, being enlisted, my concern and my exact words were to him, if you're going to enlist in the Marine Corps, find a way to get to the back of the chessboard as quickly as possible, you know, in terms of getting a specialized skill. He's very fit. He's a smart guy. And he's an outdoorsman and always has been. So I think the sniper community recognized that in him and the way he explained it to me. After the School of Infantry was over, he got tapped on the shoulder and asked if he wanted to go to the sniper screener. And he asked me about it, and I was pretty convinced that that was a great place for him. He's a good shot. He's a regular kid and, you know, fit, very competent in the woods, and not adverse to hardship and that sort of thing, which is, I think, a big part of getting through the schools, for sure, and then, obviously, on a mission.
So what would you say to the parent that their kid is, like, on that verge of joining, or they've just joined, and they want to get to a sniper section? What would be your advice from a parent's perspective?
I think there's some skill sets that would be good to have, you know, that are inherent in each person that does it. I mean, if you were like me and grew up in Manhattan, my kids grew up in Maine, but, you know, I'm not going to be the best, you know, Bronco rider growing up on East End Avenue in New York City, but Connor had the opportunity to grow up in the woods in Maine and do that sort of thing. So map and compass, mountaineering, a lot of backcountry skiing with me, a lot of outdoor activities that I enjoyed were innate. A lot of time outdoors, in tents and harsh conditions, you know, for basic camp.
The New England weather, basically.
Yeah, we don't pull into campgrounds and pop a tent, you know, or plug the trailer in. We were, you know, backpacking and winter mountaineering and that sort of thing. So he was familiar with all those aspects. And, you know, we didn't take cell phones with us except for emergencies, but never for nav. It was map and compass skills and things that translated directly into what they were going to be asking him to do in the Marine Corps and the sniper school. So
fair enough.
Yeah.
So I guess the other big reason I brought you on is because you're being a pilot, you have to understand weather. And I would say most civilians or non-pilot types, or I guess professionals, don't understand an effect weather can have on a projectile. And well, sure. As we talked about a little bit off, just going over the notes of what we're going to talk about, a jet is still a projectile. It still moves through the air just like a bullet does. It still has the ogive, the widest point of the bullet, right? And it still has a tip, and that's affected by wind and weather. And sure, the aircraft has wings, and it can use those wings to its advantage to create lift. It's not being propelled out of a slingshot, you know?
Right, it's ballistic.
Yeah, but it still has the same, we'll say, loose flight characteristics as a rocket-shaped projectile, which is just a bullet. It's essentially just a missile. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the root word of, or the root background of a bullet, it's still a missile, still a projectile. It's being forced out of something into atmospheric conditions.
Right.
So as a pilot, what's the first big thing that you have to check when you get into weather?
Well, obviously, before I go anywhere from point A to point B, the first thing I look at is weather. Whether it was in the F-18, how that would affect my mission, what kind of delivery I could use for what kind of bombing mission I was tasked on, or even at the airliner, you know, where I have 175 people in the back, I'm trying to find the best weather for the ride. And, you know, what are the conditions going to be at landing, and how much fuel do I have to take in case I have to go to an alternate, et cetera, et cetera. But the weather's everything in my job. And, you know, being in the fluid that is weather, the atmospherics for a sniper, it's similar, although I apply it slightly differently. But I think the effects of it are, you know, you can make examples of them, you know, for the short duration of the flight of a bullet is, depending on where you're at, exceedingly important to get that on target as it is for me to go from point A to point B, either in the F-18 on an attack mission or, you know, going from Cleveland to Chicago. I need to know what I'm going to face and how I'm going to move through the fluid that the bullet and I, you know, in separate scenarios would be flying through. So,
okay, so if you could explain the difference between the air density,
mm-hmm.
mean sea level, or above ground level, because I understand the difference between the three of them, right?
Yeah.
And even two of those are kind of the same thing, just different terminology.
Yeah, there's, you know, there's the MSL altitude, mean sea level altitude, and that's plugged in as our barometric altimeter. So once you get above 18,000 feet, everybody sets 2992 as a constant. And each
2992 meaning barometric pressure.
Yeah, correct. It's standard day pressure, so that we can each know, you know, airplanes going east are going to be at an odd altitude, airplanes going west are going to be at an even altitude, and that gives us our 1,000-foot separation. But just in terms of how an airplane responds, for instance, in the F-18 at 500 feet, I could go to full power and sustain a high G load in a very dynamic turn, where in that same airplane at a much higher altitude with a lot less air molecules, air density for the wings to gain lift off of, you know, that the radius of my turn would be much bigger and the G load would be much less. So there's less friction in lower density altitudes and more friction in higher density altitudes. And I guess
so. The higher in elevation I am, the more force against the projectile I have? Is that what you're saying? Or the other way around?
The other way around. The lower you are, the more air molecules. I mean, when you dive into a pool, you know, if you go down to the deep end and stick your finger in the drain, your ears might hurt because you now have, on top of the atmospheric pressure, the weight of the water above you in the pool pushing in on your eardrum. So the higher the density, the more friction or more air molecules for the airplane to utilize for lift. And the higher up you go, say in the mid-30s, 35,000 feet or so, where the jet is typically most efficient, the least number of air molecules to provide what's called parasite drag, and which is drag.
Which, when we get into bullets, that's like your G1 versus your G7, which is how wide the bullet is. And think of it as like a boat moving through the water, how much of a wake the bullet makes when it's gliding through. Same concept for aircraft, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, if you're going super fast in the speedboat, the wake is very narrow. And if, you know,
the wider my boat is, the bigger the wake.
The bigger
and
the wake.
If I'm a listener, I'm thinking about bullets. The only portion of the wind that affects the bullet is at the very tip, right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at photos of I don't want to say a high-speed camera, but like a thermal or infrared camera,
mm-hmm.
that can see the bullet as it moves through the air, it's literally just the tip of the bullet that's contacting it. So the apex is actually separating and moving all the air molecules aside.
Mm-hmm.
So in theory, if you were to look at this in like layman's terms, you could say the rest of the bullet isn't touching air because it's being separated and moved apart.
Sure.
Which gets into the aspect of and I'm going to use this as a loose example. If I'm flying from Boston to, we'll say, Kansas,
mm-hmm.
okay, and I'm flying through the air and just the tip of my aircraft is touching it, moving everything else aside, right?
Right.
The fatter it is, the harder it is for me to continue that flight over time, correct?
Yeah, the more drag you would have.
Right.
The wider the body of the airplane, the larger the drag. And then, of course, some of that's mitigated, you know, by the length of the fuselage. And
or the length of the bullet.
Yeah, the length of the bullet, that sort of thing.
So my other question for this is, so learning as I go through a lot of this stuff, and this is kind of my question too, I'm learning through this podcast, and hopefully other people are, but if I have, most people don't know that the weight of, like if I look at a box, mm-hmm. and it says I'm shooting 30.6 or 30 dot, or you would say decimal, mm-hmm. 0.6, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it gives the grain weight, so say 125 grain, 170 grain, 180 grain, right?
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't know that that's the actual weight of the bullet, not the amount of grains in the casing.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. So what we're talking about is the weight of the bullet itself, separated from everything else, just mm-hmm. a standalone bullet.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm shooting, the heavier bullets will go farther, right? Let's say I have a bullet that is 125 grains and I have a bullet that's 140 grains or 150 grains. We'll just double mm-hmm. it, right? The bullet that's going 150 grains will be able to resist gravitational pull at, let's say they're going the same speeds or relatively the same speed, say 2,700 between the two bullets, mm-hmm. right? So 2,700 feet per second, both bullets, one's 125, one's 40 grain,
mm-hmm.
or 140 grain. The one that's 140 grain will be able to go further, and it further meaning it will be able to not drop as fast because it's resisting the gravitational pull and the effects of weather because it's going the same speed as something that's lighter. Mm-hmm. Versus lighter can have – the gravity can have a more immediate effect on that lighter projectile. Mm-hmm. So is it the same for aircraft where a heavier aircraft will actually kind of glide a little bit longer and resist some of those?
When you
and get I know flying, like, eventually you're going to sink like a rock. It's going to happen. But, you know, if I take two airplanes and one's a Cessna and one's F-18, right?
Now we're talking about range in the aviation side of the house.
So, well, that's kind of the same thing for bullets. I have a range of the bullet.
Of course. So if you let's simplify it and say that you have two sailplanes flying side by side on the same day with equal performance, and one weighs more than the other, the heavier sailplane will go farther faster than the lighter sailplane because given the, you know, anomalies of the atmosphere, the lighter sailplane won't have what we term as much penetration. So it is more subject to the variables that you're talking about, whereas the heavier sailplane with exactly the same glide characteristics, or, you know, how many feet forward for every foot down, it will go there faster and be less susceptible. And so that's why you'll see guys that compete in sailplanes. If it's a really good day with lots of lift, they'll put water ballast in their airplanes to speed up their time.
Really?
As they're trying to go around a course on the ground, typically a triangle. I've never actually competed in that. My dad was a big sailplane guy, so the heavier airplane on a good day, you would give up climb rates in the thermals, but you would make...
Thermals meaning pockets of warm air.
Pockets of air that are climbing. But you would track faster over the ground. So there's sort of a crossover point, anything I would suppose traveling through the atmosphere, whether you're, you know, hiding in the weeds, shooting very close to the ground, or, you know, shooting across a valley, you know, the atmospherics are... They play a role in anything that operates in the air.
What about humidity? How does that play a part? Because every shooting school I've gone to, don't worry about humidity, set it to 50. Meaning on my ballistic calculator, whether I have Strelak Pro or I'm using a Kestrel, which is just a high speed, it's a computer with atmospheric, it's two things, a ballistic computer and an atmospheric computer. It measures, you know, your temperature, it measures your air density, measures your altitude, which is kind of the same thing as air density, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It goes off your mean sea level and air density, right? But then you've got humidity, you've got barometric pressure, all those things. So what does humidity really do for a projectile?
Well, for an airplane, humidity puts water, you know, that's what it is. It's mm-hmm. water molecules in the air that don't contribute much to flying. They impede it a little bit, actually. So say, for instance, I was going to land an airplane at a certain weight at a runway of a certain length that was kind of short, and I noticed that the temperatures were going to be high, say 90 degrees and 90% humidity, which is basically max humidity. That's going to increase my airspeed and my ground speed, you know, for an indicated airspeed that the airspeed indicator is reading how many air molecules I'm smashing into. So an equivalent airspeed, say we're in a smaller airplane like a Mooney, and I'm coming into a field that's 3,500 feet long, or thinking about landing in a field that's 3,500 feet long, and I'm heavyweight, high temperature, which is a low air density, and then inside that low air density is a lot of water, my ground speed may be much higher than I had forecasted, you know, and in a Mooney maybe 10 to 15 knots more.
So
that affects my ground roll and my possible stopping margin. So
if I, let's say you put that, like, you know what a chronograph is, right?
Sure.
Right, so it just measures the speed from point A to point B as a projectile is passing through it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say I've got 100% humidity. Do you think I'd see a couple hundred feet difference between 100% humidity and 50% humidity if I'm shooting through that chronograph?
I would think so, yeah, because you're not going through the less dense air, you're going through the higher density water. I mean, it's how it works in an airplane, so I would assume that even the smaller projectiles would have a significant effect, especially when you're shooting at small targets at long range.
I'll have to ask around, because everywhere I see, everyone's like, at least the professional instructors I've been with, have always been like, nope, 50% humidity, it doesn't matter. And my always thought process
maybe
was,
if it's 50%, but at a higher humidity level, I don't know. Maybe it's slightly different, because, of course, in the airplane, I'm looking to produce lift. And the bullet is ballistic. You know?
Yeah.
The shot's made when you squeeze the trigger, but I would have to assume that, you know, air density, whether it's with water or high density or low density altitudes, you know, where the air is thicker, like clearly on a cold day, the jet produces much more power than on a hot day, even at ground level. You know, so the jet would be rated for, say, 32,000 pounds of thrust. Am I actually getting that if it's 90 degrees out? No, and I have to take all those things into consideration when I'm taking off out of Phoenix on a summer day, or I'm taking off out of Portland, Maine in the fall. It's kind of nice. The jet performs really well with thicker, denser, cold, dry air.
So if you were to, let's say you come across a guy or gal or someone, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I want to be all gender inclusive, like mm-hmm. Apache attack helicopter. I'm sure someone self-identifies as that. But if I've got I've got someone who doesn't understand wind. They don't understand how wind flows.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe how wind flows? Let's say I just have an open flat ground and an open square, like on a kitchen table, like we're sitting at.
Right.
And wind's moving across the kitchen table. How would you explain to them how to visually identify what they can't see?
Well, for me, you know, I've got charts that are giving me winds aloft and that sort of thing at different altitudes. You know, the weather geeks throw up the balloons and they get their
the nerds,
their readings, and you know, airplanes report in all of the data that every airliner is encountering, is spewing the data back to NOAA and, you know, the National whatever observatory, and so you get an idea where the winds are, where the jet stream is, so forth and so on. So it's really important to me to know where the jet stream is, especially if I'm going from east to west.
The jet stream meaning the main avenue of travel for wind?
Well,
if I'm to think of it in the water, right? Like you have currents in the water. That's the same thing as a jet stream.
Yeah,
right?
The jet stream's like think of it as the Gulf Stream. You know, it goes up the east coast and then bears off Newfoundland. The jet stream typically comes out of the northwest, makes some sort of dip over the United States, whether it goes all the way south down to Texas or rips across Missouri, and then it typically curves back up off New England, which accounts for, you know, the ludicrous wind speeds recorded at Mount Washington, because as it makes that turn, it ducks down. And actually, the jet stream does occasionally touch the top of Mount Washington, causing those really high winds. So
yeah, I know we've got the record on Mount Washington for 200 mile an hour winds.
236, yeah, something like that. It's bananas.
Which everyone from the Midwest complains that they have, you know, the craziest wind speeds, and they'll be like, oh yeah, I'm shooting in Kansas and it's 50 mile an hour winds. Well, yeah, dude, it's from left to right all day, same constant wind speed. So it's like having zero wind speed. You get to New England and it's, or even in the Rockies, and it's moving across valleys and up and down. It may only be 15 to 20 miles an hour in a valley, but it's going to go 15 to 20, 3 to 5, 12 to 10. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, it's going to be different wind gradients. And what most people don't realize is, and well, you touched on this a little bit, between getting to that 18,000 foot mark, winds change again.
Sure.
And the same thing like a bullet. As a bullet's going from where your barrel is to the target, it has what we call a max ordnance. Mm-hmm. And the max ordnance is how high off the ground the bullet will be at its maximum arc.
Right.
And the way that we usually think of this is, let's say I have a target at 1,000 yards,
mm-hmm.
right? It's 50% of that 1,000 plus 10% is the max height that my bullet will be off of. So at, you know, 550 yards, that's the max height that my bullet will be off the ground.
And then it begins the
and
the
then
drop.
It'll drop. Target. So that's a real big thing, because if I'm shooting from valley to valley, I need to know what the winds are like at ish halfway across that valley. And that's going to be 550 feet above,
mm-hmm.
or well, not 550 feet above, but it'll be whatever your foot difference is above that. And you can take that and, you know, you have a calculator and it'll show you that at 550 yards, your bullet is 300 feet off the ground, we'll just say. Or 100, we'll say it's 100 feet off the ground to keep it simple.
It was like dive bombing for me with a ballistic bomb. I would have to rely on the airplane's computers and radar to give me an accurate offset aim point if I was dropping, say, from 20,000 feet with a 2,000-pound conical fin bomb. to make sure that as it traveled through these different winds, unfortunately, even the APG-65 radar could pick up on particulate matter and its movements and come up with a quick gauge on the average offset. And then the attack cursors, if I was in the automatic bombing mode, I would fly the platform to a steady a position with the least amount of calculations for the computer to make. Ideally a steady state airspeed and 0.9 Gs, and then the bomb and the system would figure out where to put the
point of aim, cursor. Point of impact.
Exactly. So it would account for the offset aim point and the flight path of the bomb down to the target so I could get it as close to possible.
Well,
as possible.
Unfortunately, us lesser common, you know, village folk on the ground, we only have a bullet that once it leaves the barrel does what it does.
But it's the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. When I push the pickle switch in the F-18 to drop the ordnance, I'm basically similar, slightly different parameter, but I am shooting a bullet at that point. I'm dropping the bullet and accounting for its ballistic flight.
So one thing that I get asked all the time is, what portion of the bullet trajectory do I read wind? Do I read wind close to the barrel or on the shooter's face, we'll say? Like, if I'm in a shooting position and I feel the wind on my face, am I making my wind call when there? Am I making my wind call halfway? Or am I making my wind call at the target? Now, in the past, I've been told you make your wind call at the target, because that when your bullet gets to the target, that's the slowest speed it's going to be in the entire trajectory of flight.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to focus on the wind at that point. However, I recently saw a thing that I need to focus on the bullet's wind where it gets affected the most. And I'll give you an example. Say I'm shooting a target at 1,000 yards, right? Mm-hmm. And at 1,000 yards, the wind is left to right at 10 miles an hour, right? But at 500 yards, it's 20 miles an hour. So which wind is going to have more effect? The one at, 1,000 with 10 mile an hour winds, or the one at 500 with 20 mile an hour winds? Which one's going to have a greater effect?
I would obviously think that the higher the winds, it's sort of like a golfer reading the grass on the green for a long putt. You know, the grass may affect the rolling ball, but the slower the ball goes is typically when we see the greatest movement of the golf ball. You know, those guys that are experts at putting, they'll, you know, the ball may in the last 4 feet move to the left or the right 6 or 7 inches, depending on which way the green goes. But it makes sense to me that the least effect would be at right out of the muzzle, because you're moving the fastest, you're transiting that area the quickest, and now as the bullet is slowing down, it's spending more time in the more dynamic conditions of the
so
wind.
If you were going to shoot, would you focus on where the wind is the strongest or where the wind is closest to the target?
Well, you know, I'm...
What would you do as an F-18 pilot? Because I can see you smiling trying to get out of this answer.
Absolutely. Fortunately, you know, my out is that the APG-65 radar...
Oh, okay. But even on the radar systems, okay.
Could read pretty accurately particulate matter in the atmosphere and... come up with an offset aim point. When I was dropping bombs...
So if you were working through the calculator and the computer failed, where would you focus more? On the wind halfway to the target, where it's the strongest, or the wind at the target?
I would probably look at the... You know, it might be slightly different
You had to do it manually.
If I knew the winds were very high at, say, medium altitude, which would be like 20,000 feet, I would make a wag into that. But at that point, it would be a pure wag. And if I had the luxury of being able to come around again, I would look at where the bomb hit based on the conditions of my offset aim
point. So second round impacts.
And then I would moderate that. So say I hit 10 o'clock at 100 feet, I'd be like, all right, I need to aim, you know, slightly closer to the bull at 50 feet and try and get the azimuth right on the 12 o'clock. But that would be the second drop.
So what you're saying is kind of like what I've told everyone before. And in theory, right, let's say in each PRS stage, I shoot 10 rounds at each stage, and I have 10 stages, so 100 rounds of ammo for the day, right? Mm-hmm. If I go to each stage and I send a burner round down there, kind of like what we're talking about, I send a bomb, I send a projectile, I watch its impact, I get the corrections, and then I send that same correction every single time. In theory, if the wind stays, if my wind stays the same and stays constant, that I will be guaranteed 9 shots or 8 shots on target every single time.
Right.
And in theory, I could win every PRS match playing it that way, that I could send a burner.
Wouldn't that be glorious?
It would be. And however, I know there are guys that try it. Yeah, however, comma. And I know there are guys that are trying it. And I encourage guys to do it all the time. Like, hey, man, like when I was shooting the New England PRS match 2 weekends ago, there are times where I could see my impacts, right? Mm-hmm. I'd be watching the guy before me, like, right here, I can see his impacts. I'd be watching through my spot and scope. I can see his impacts. All right. Hey, dude, when he comes up the line, hey, man, what are you holding for wind? Oh, I'm holding 2 mils. All right, roger that. I go up there, I'll start on a 2 mil hold. All right, I missed that target, so obviously we're not at 2 mil wins anymore. And that's probably one thing I keep, bringing up with guys before in the podcast, is that that's why I like precision rifle shooting better than pistol shooting or three gun or PCC, which is pistol caliber carbine, right? Like a 9mm M4 or an M16, as the old guys, like you would call it, the muskets.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that.
Yeah, no problem, Davy Crockett. You probably had A2 front sight posts from Vietnam. Dad and you probably shot the same rifle at base training. Guaranteed. Anyway, I digress before you can answer. I'll send a burner down there, and obviously I'm not a 2 mil hold anymore, so I got to figure it out. All right. Mm. I watch my impact and how close it is to the edge of the plate, how close it is to the edge of the target.
Sure.
And then I have to figure out from the edge of the target to the center of the target how far that is, and that's my true wind hold. Mm. And I make that adjustment, and I send it in there again. Now, obviously, like in an airplane, you get bounced around a little bit, so your reticle's moving around. And sometimes the stable position sets it up. No different than your glide approach or your angle of attack into the target.
Yeah, it was typically like a 30-degree dive.
So you're building your position basically into the target.
Yeah, so you would try to build a stable platform in the dive and drive to the release point.
No different than I would do it on a rifle.
Yeah. Okay. It's pretty similar, kind of. I mean, obviously...
That's why we're talking about
parameters,
it.
Parameters, yeah. But pretty similar.
I mean, so we were talking earlier, and I mentioned to you about how you'd explain to wind. How would you explain it to someone that doesn't understand wind, how to visually kind of go about understanding it? And the way I was trying to get at it was, we were talking earlier about the F-18 breaking the sound barrier, and it's going supersonic, no different than a projectile comes out of there. So could you explain what happens leading up to breaking the sound barrier, what happens in the transition between... not being the speed of sound and then being the speed of sound, that transonic zone. What happens in the transonic zone? Because there are, and I'm going to use this term lightly here, and someone's going to get super excited and pitch something in their tent, and there are guys that are going to get they're going to get really upset. So I see all the time with FUDs, meaning that, you know, like Elmer Fudd, right? The guy that goes, every bullet that goes in the transonic zone, whether it's going subsonic to supersonic, or vice versa, supersonic to subsonic. It's transitioning, right? Mm-hmm. When it goes through that transition zone, it destabilizes. And I go, that's not true. Because if you had a destabilization in the transonic zone, aircrafts would freaking explode. So there's no way, you can't have a bullet go out of control in transonic. And transonic, for those listening, when a bullet comes out of the barrel, it's going from zero to its max speed, right out of the barrel, right? So the second the bullet comes out of the barrel, it's at its max speed. It has gone from subsonic, transonic, to supersonic. If that were the case, and even if it's, let's say I'm at 1,000 yards, I'm going subsonic again. So at 999.9999 yards, I break through that transonic zone. I go from supersonic to subsonic. And in between those zones, we have the transonic. If everything was to destabilize in the transonic zone, airplanes would just lose control and blow up.
Well,
so what happens in that transonic zone from a guy who's physically been in the transonic zone?
So, well, just as an aside here, it's kind of interesting. The Bell X-1, which was the first aircraft to go supersonic with, you know, everybody's favorite battery salesman, Chuck Yeager.
I won't tell him you said that.
I would. He's never landed on a ship.
Oh, man, some Navy dude right now just lost his, or some Air Force guy just lost his mind.
They modeled the shape of the X-1 on a 50 caliber bullet.
Interesting.
Because they knew that went supersonic. So here's what happens. You're ripping along, and in the F-18, not much changes because there's a lot of computers taking inputs.
Yeah, all the...
airplane is designed to be dynamically unstable. So without the inputs of computers and things like that, even the F-18, which is sort of getting old now...
You're going to be considered the biplane pilots from World War I now. It's coming up soon, brother.
So it's interesting. As you go supersonic, there's typically a blow off of vapor.
Which is the white cloud that you can see,
right?
The white
cloud that everybody's seen photographs, sort of a conical cloud that forms on the airplane. And that is because the air is no longer aerodynamic. It can't go over the airplane in a laminar type flow anymore. So it breaks off into a shock wave. And it's, if you've ever looked through those cameras where you slide the diagonal to focus and the two edges of the image meet, if I were, say, not that I've ever done this, buzzed a submarine, one of the boomers coming home off cruise, out over the warning areas, and I was at 100 feet, and all the boys in the sub were up in the conning tower with their KPOX and binoculars, and I would sneak up behind, allegedly, I could know exactly when they would bounce. And by that I mean when they would hear the sonic boom, because I could look down my wing line, and it presented a shift. And instead of everything being clear, it was clear, but there was a break in the clarity where the shock wave actually was. So
for us, that would be like the trace. So what you're talking about is your bullet or your aircraft is pushing aside the air like water. And when I look through a spotting scope, I can see the bullet as it's moving through the air. And we call that seeing trace, meaning like if you think of the
vapor
movie.
Trail.
Yeah, vapor trail. Yeah, yeah. So but if I think of the movie Matrix, and there's a scene in the original Matrix where Neo is like dodging the bullets,
yeah,
and it looks like it's pushing water behind it, that's what we see through spotting scopes. And I imagine what you're talking about is you're seeing
the actual shockwave, and it comes off
the actual wall.
The faster you go, it's like if this was, you know, you were looking at two pencils together, or there's a break. So the submarine, the front of the submarine would be above the back of the submarine as the shockwave went by, as I'm looking at it, because the shockwave is distorting it because it's no longer aerodynamic flow.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And so like when you hear a thunderbolt, what's happening there is, you know, the lightning comes through and burns out the air, and then the atmosphere slams back together, and that's what makes the thunder. Which is kind of crazy.
This is totally cool. Like I never thought that our podcast would get to this level. We're talking about that molecules slamming together and making explosions in the air.
And so as I would finish being supersonic after giggling.
So you're pushing through the transonic, becoming
I'm
subsonic.
Coming back down through it, there would be a change in the center of gravity of the airplane. So, you know, say you balance your cell phone on your finger, dead nuts in the middle of your cell phone, coming back down through it, it would pitch up. So we called it getting a G for free. So if you needed to maneuver hard and you were supersonic and you were going to make a hard turn, naturally the airplane's going to slow down as you're cornering hard, and it now weighs 8 times what it did when you were straight and level. You decelerate, and then you get a bump and an extra pitch as the center of gravity shifts on the airplane again.
So now let's relate this back to shooting, because that's what we're about.
Sorry.
So my which is totally cool.
What,
to
it's
talking
not all about
this.
Me? No,
not right now, Captain. All right, fucking Jack Sparrow over here. All right, so bullet hits subsonic, then hits transonic when it comes out of the barrel, hits supersonic, goes towards the end of its flight path, hits transonic,
mm-hmm.
right? It's transitioning out of subsonic, then becomes subsonic. When it hits that transonic zone and comes out, does it become gyroscopically destabilized to where the bullet will, say, make a 45-degree pitch off randomly or 90 degrees somewhere? It will still stay in the relatively same flight path, correct?
I would assume so. I guess now you're getting into things that I don't know the topic about. But
well,
if
you're flying with your airplane and you don't touch it, and you go from supersonic, transonic, subsonic, and you don't touch your airplane, hands off the controls, you're not going to bounce off randomly and go somewhere.
No. But I could see perhaps with a ballistic projectile that accelerated to supersonic and then begins to slow down to subsonic, where aerodynamic flow then is actually conforming to the shape of the bullet, there might be a slight period of time in there where, you know, it's...
What we're talking about is the circle in which it's
I would think it might, you know,
this,
the
gyroscopic. So as bullet goes out, yeah, it has a gyroscopic circle. So the bullet's twisting and then making another circle because it's twisting. So what you're talking about is, like, think of a dreidel. If I put a dreidel on a table and I spin it,
right,
and it starts to slow down, it wobbles a little bit but still stays on the same point of contact. So as the bullet's going through the air, it's still staying on the point of contact, but the end of the bullet is becoming destabilized like a dreidel,
Right.
And it's getting a wider circle until it impacts, or what we call it is going to sleep. The bullet then becomes restabilized as it becomes subsonic because it's getting its chi for free. Yeah. It's therefore restabilizing itself. Wow. So the same projectile, in theory, still does the same thing as an aircraft. It gets its chi for free and tightens back down on its gyroscopic circle.
But it's, you know, like, speaking of gyros, you know, a gyro in an airplane that we use for navigation precesses at a predetermined rate, and it's called the Schuler loop. So it will come past null, like you'll align your gyros to tell you I am at this known point, and then I'm going to go out and flop around and use that as navigation. Over the course of time, the Schuler loop, it will go to a larger swing and come back to null. But fortunately, you know, the Hornet only had enough gas for a few hours of flying. But so I would see that, you know, a bullet in a very short time flight may have some of that gyroscopic, I don't know, better term is drift in terms of the bullet.
Widening.
And then being able to come back, just like the Schuler loop on our gyros and the
going
dreidel
to sleep.
You were talking to about. Yeah. Yeah, you would eventually get back to a null set, depending on the time of flight of the bullet and how hard it was twisting in its normal flight instead of spiraling like a well-thrown football. You know, you might get that little wobble in there.
Yeah, it's no different than throwing a football. If I have that little bit of wobble from the tail end, it doesn't go off randomly. It's still going to continue along its flight path of point of aim. It will may become a it'll
obviously, I think if it's not flying the way the bullet was designed right as it came out, I could see that developing more drag and maybe shortening.
Well, what you might be hinting on is when you have a chip in the crown. So as the bullet's coming out of the barrel and you have a chip, it will get nicked by that chip in the crown. It's like an indent, right?
Sure.
And it will cause the bullet to change completely because, you know, like a 308 can, the last that I saw a couple of years ago, because now you have recessed crowns where the end of the barrel is slightly recessed inside, like,
right.
Think of it as like I have a larger circular diameter and I have another circular diameter inside of that, but that's pushed back a little bit. So the end of the barrel is protected because it's indented in. It's called the recessed crown. It's hard to chip that. And if it is chipped, like a 308 will have like 18 inches deviation left or right at 100 yards. So if I have a chip on the right side of the barrel, if I remember correctly, it'll show 18 inches deviation to the right or vice versa, whatever it is.
The only thing I would think that if the bullet wasn't flying like a perfectly tossed football, it would now be exposing more surface area and developing, like an airplane, you know, with the flaps and the gear out, more parasite drag.
But it slows down, but it doesn't change direction.
No, it wouldn't go left or right. I would only think it would affect the up and down portion in terms of the
dropping faster.
And would end up maybe perhaps falling short of the target if the bullet did that.
If it was that bad.
Yeah.
I mean, we're still pushing it, you know, that's going to be when you're below 1,000 feet per second at a target. You know, that's when you start seeing it. But most, let's say I'm shooting a 6.5 Creedmoor, I'm pushing 2,700 feet per second. By the time I get to like 1,200 yards or anywhere in that area, I'm still at like, you know, I'm still over Mach 1.2, you know. Or if I'm under it, I'm under it by only, you know, a couple hundred feet per second. So it's not the end of the world.
Right.
The bullet will still have at that point traveled so far already and gravity will have already pulled it down enough that it's not going to matter. But a lot of the guys I see in New England are really concerned that I can't shoot a certain 55 grain 223 projectile past 600 because they say that the bullet will go subsonic and therefore become unstable in flight, which to me is just kind of an uneducated thing to say because we know that it's not going to go 45, 90 degrees out of the way. As we've just discussed, it's like a football. It's not going to change direction. If anything, it's going to drop faster because it's producing more drag over a larger surface area.
Right.
In theory. In theory, it's like a bucking Bronco. If the Bronco's going through the wind and it turns its butt a little bit sideways, it creates drag and therefore becomes destabilized and slows down, but it doesn't like jump all of a sudden out of the range parameters.
It's not going to – I wouldn't think the azimuth would have, you know – lateral azimuth would have any massive effects,
right?
You know,
so So, yeah, such an interesting topic. We could probably talk for days with weather. I know we're pushing it quite a bit. I'm sure some guys are going to listen to the car and be like, dude, my brain's blown. You're going to have Jack back on. So I have so many more questions about weather and stuff. So I'll come up with some more stuff, and we'll have you back on the podcast.
Awesome.
Because we'd like to talk. I know you did some shooting as a kid, and we'll talk about that a little bit. We'll do another two episodes, and we'll grab some beer and chit-chat. So, Jack, thanks for being on the podcast, man. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
Yeah, we'll get you on again, man.
All right.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
Cheers.